This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. We're on remote. I'm Grace Cavalieri. We're very excited to talk to Ocean Vuong. He is the recipient of the MacArthur Genius Award. He's the author of the New York Times bestselling novel, On Earth, We're Briefly Gorgeous, out from Penguin. And it is forthcoming in 30 languages. He's received the MacArthur Award, as I said. He's also the author of a poetry collection, Night Sky with Exit Wounds. And this was a New York Times top 10 book of 2016. It won the T.S. Eliot Prize. We would be up very late if I read all of his credits, but we'll hear little by little throughout this time. Welcome, Ocean. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Grace. It's a pleasure and a deep honor to be in such a, in well-esteemed, because great esteem of authors who come on here. It's a deep pleasure.
Well, 44 years, and this is a highlight for me. I truly mean that. Now, when I talk to people about your work, and I've said this to you before, they respond that they are reverent about it. And I thought that was a really good topic to bring up with you, because reverence is not admiration and love. It's something else. It's a kind of devotion to your work. And I wonder what you want to say about that, thinking it may come from your reverence to your work.
Yeah, I'm happy people feel that way. You know, you never know what happens when you write or how it'll be received. I think as a poet, many of us poets are taught early on or told early on that we shouldn't expect any readers. Nobody reads poetry. you know, the great myth of it is that we're shouting into the void. And I think, well, that's not so bad. A lot of incredible work is made seemingly speaking into the void. You know, I live down the street essentially from Emily Dickinson, one of my heroes. And so much of her readership was not promised to her even in her lifetime. And I think when I come to poetry, I see it as a representation, a linguistic, idiosyncratic representations of somebody's personhood. But not only that, it is their best version of themselves. And I don't mean decorous or righteous. I mean the most considered, because there's so much care put into every line, every draft. You know, Lord knows we have maybe even hundreds of drafts per poem. And so when you're reading a poem, there is no other way but to be reverent, because this is somebody at their best. Someone is giving you at their best moment of themselves, the most compact, compressured, and most considered self. And so that is a very special engagement to me. I think at the sake of sounding too grandiose, I think it's really sacred.
It's holy work. I believe that is holy work. I think it's connected to the divine. And in that way, we get a kind of a devotion and a kind of reverence for language. And also because you are so courageous and truthful, you open your heart, you see what falls out, you put it on the page, you make it look pretty on the page. Mm-hmm. And so my take on you is that you have this gentle language that triggers these powerful emotions. Now, that's quite a conflict. Beautiful language, patient speaking, and then it has this tumultuous effect on us.
Right. I think the best things in our world, if we look at the world as an edifying project, to examine and observe phenomena as a work of edification, I think we can see that a lot of the best things happen slowly. You know, some of the most lasting, most meaningful things, even in nature, from, you know, mountains to trees and everything that we come to know and love happens slowly. And so, you know, I want to learn from that. I'm an apprentice of a sentence in a way, and I'm also an apprentice of the world. And so much of writing is also about observation, without judgment, without quick binary takes. You know, we live in a world where we're inundated by that. The media tells us we should like this and we should not like that. But poetry allows us to say, well, wait a minute. How I have this great luxury of not determining anything. Indeterminacy is so liberating and a balm to our psyche. And I think I try to learn from that in order to fashion my work. And I give myself permission to be lost, in a sense. Mm,
I love that. And I know we can't dream in a hurry. So how do we think we can write in a hurry? Right. So maybe this is the gift you give us to remind us to slow down, to appreciate nature more, to not only rinse off language, but to just not try to dream in a hurry. So with that thought in mind, would you please read us a poem? Ocean Vuong, this is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress.
Absolutely. This poem is called Trojan. And I've always, you know, as a child, all the way to throughout my education, have been enamored of the Trojan horse, that myth. And I always wondered about the horse. I worried about the horse, you know. I said, it's this vehicle that was the site of war and deception. And I thought, well, if the horse could speak, what would it say, you know? So I got caught up on the sidelines, as is very common with myself. And so this poem came out of it. Trojan. A finger swerf of dark from daybreak. He steps into a red dress, a flame caught in a mirror the width of a coffin, steel glinting in the back of his throat, a flash, a white asterisk. Look how he dances. The bruised blue wallpaper peeling into hooks as he twirls. His horse head shadow thrown on the family portraits, glass cracking beneath its stain. He moves like any other fracture, revealing the briefest doors. The dress petaling off him like the skin of an apple, as if their swords aren't sharpening inside him. This horse with its human face, this belly full of blades and brutes, as if dancing could stop the heart of his murderer from beating between his ribs. How easily a boy in a dress, the red of shut eyes, vanishes beneath the sound of his own galloping. Mm. How a horse will run until it breaks into weather, into wind. How like the wind they will see him. They will see him clearest when the city burns.
That is the voice of Ocean Vuong. I'm Grace Cavalieri. We're at the Library of Congress. In one sense, we are virtual. One theme that I respond to in your work is the one of desire. And desire is a big deal. It's not only the interpersonal that you reflect so beautifully, but desire is what makes everything work. It makes us get up in the morning. I have a line that says, run, swim, row toward it. Mm-hmm. So desire is how we manage to want to write, to want to teach. And so you've taken desire and made it a crystal in your heart. But don't you think it ramifies to a greater thing?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, desire ultimately is a law of attraction. And the law, one law of attraction called gravity, is how we even exist. It's what pins us into this world. And so it's what makes the very planets that, you know, behold our universe. And so I think I'm reverent to desire as well. I want to learn from it. And I think what we want says so much about who we are. And so the modulation and the meditation on desire can lead to great moments of revelation within a text and within life. And contrary to that, on the other hand, as a Buddhist, we are taught right away that desire causes suffering. Mm. And it sounds very morbid and dooming, but in fact, it's quite, I think, it has this deep wisdom that to want is to hurt.
Yes, that
and how, and the poem becomes a map through and out of hurt. That really excites me.
Oh, that excites me too. So that desire is a conundrum to us because it creates attachment to things. And our whole lives are spent trying to release from being attached. And I think that push-pull is in your work. And I think it's in your life. Because what do you want, Ocean? Surely there is something you want right now. But the fact of the matter is that when we attach to anything, then something else comes up. So don't you think that this tumult under your work shows up?
Yes, absolutely. And I think for me, it's not so helpful to judge it or condemn, you know, ideas or feelings one way or another. I mean, there's plenty of places in our culture where things can be condemned or celebrated. I think in poetry, doubt, uncertainty, even fear and discomfort are sites of energy. The friction that comes out of doubt and uncertainty and want and hurt, those things are, they propel us towards the next questions. In a way, I see the poem closely related to the essay in that it is an attempt to go back to the French etymology, to try to build an architecture for query. That to me is the strongest and potent sort of role for the poem in my life.
And the fact that we do not try to persuade is the secret ingredient.
Yes, yes. To allow the poem to be an object observed in an almost democratic medium of language. You can approach it at any side, any angle, and each reader can come to it on her own terms.
I can't imagine life without your writing. I can't imagine what you would be in life without your poetry. It is so
me neither. Me neither.
It's your DNA. Yeah. I mean, I know people who write poetry, and I know people who are ambitiously writing poetry. But when you talk to a poet whose very the rhythm of his blood is on the page, that's pretty hot, Ocean. That is pretty hot. May we have another poem?
Yes.
Ocean Vuong.
To continue with the classical themes, this one is called Eurydice. It's more like the sound a doe makes when the arrowhead replaces the day with an answer to the ribs' hollowed hum. We saw it coming, but kept walking through the hole in the garden because the leaves were pure green and the fire only a pink brush stroke in the distance. Mm-hmm. It's not about the light, but how dark it makes you depending on where you stand. Depending on where you stand, your name can sound like a full moon shredded in a dead doe's pelt. Your name changed when touched by gravity. Gravity breaking our kneecaps just to show us the sky. Why did we keep saying yes, even with all those birds? Who would believe us now? My voice cracking like bones inside the radio. Silly me. I thought love was real and the body imaginary. I thought a little cord was all it took. But here we are, standing in the cold field again. Him calling for the girl beside him, frosted grass snapping beneath her hooves.
If I want to teach one of Jung's principles of sensuality, the colors in your poem, the crackling in your poem, the sounds in your poem, I will teach you. Another of your themes is the father in literature. And this can't be oversaid that in every culture, the father in literature is predominant. And I mean, I can name 100 poets right off the top of my head. Stanley Kunitz, The Portrait, comes first to mind. Yes. And certainly it is profoundly influencing your work. What, when I know you're writing privately, but are you aware of the great continuum that you're adding to the canon with the father as influencing us?
Yes, I think for me, I'm deeply interested in the father with the lowercase n, the capital, because despite being a Buddhist, I am an American. I am informed by the politics and values of this culture and this country. And, you know, I insist on critiquing it and learning from it and being a part of it. And, you know, one nation under God, the Holy Father, is part and parcel of who we are, whether we are of religious faith or not. And so I think my first book as a poet is heavily steeped in the father, right? We talk about forefathers in this country all the time. And so it's an attempt to cast my little pebble, my little stone, in the American tradition of poetry by mythologizing my own lineage. You know, and I think the work that I did in Night Sky is a work of mythology, because so many of Vietnamese lives were seen only with pity. You know, we were the boat people, we were the refugees, and we were folks who simply needed help and then were kind of out of the picture after the war. And I wanted to say, well, if Homer could mythologize his milieu towards a literary, testimony, then what would happen if I did the same with these folks? What would happen if Vietnamese lives were treated with the mythologizing power of the metaphor and the lyric? So that was kind of really exciting to me as an American writer.
And then we have to turn to your novel, which reveals so much of this. Now, your novel was read by our book club, and I think that is extremely cool. I think book clubs should read all of your work. We could change the world, book club by book club, you know?
Yes, I agree.
And it is really a stunning novel. I thought for a minute, I made the mistake of saying it was a memoir. It is not. It is a novel. It is fiction. And would you please read us an excerpt?
Yes, absolutely.
Beautiful book. I want to give the title, and it is On Earth, We're Briefly Gorgeous. I love that.
Thank you. I called it, I can only have written a novel. I think a memoir takes a lot of courage that I don't necessarily have. And so I rely on my imagination to take me forward. And well, of course, we can talk about that further. But because I am your son, what I know of work, I know equally of loss. And what I know of both, I know of your hands. They're once supple contours I've never felt. The palms already calloused and blistered long before I was born, then ruined further from 3 decades in factories and nail salons. Your hands are hideous, Ma, and I hate everything that made them that way. I hate how they are the wreck and reckoning of a dream. How you come home night after night, plop down on the couch and fall asleep inside a minute. I'd come back with your glass of water and you'd already be snoring, your hands in your lap like 2 partially scaled fish. What I know is that the nail salon is more than a place of work and workshop for beauty. It is also a place where our children are raised, a number of whom, like cousin Victor, will get asthma from years of breathing the noxious fumes into their still developing lungs. The salon is also a kitchen where, in the back rooms, our women squat on the floor over huge woks that pop and sizzle over electric burners. Cauldrons of pho simmer and steam up the cramped spaces with aromas of cloves, cinnamon, ginger, mint, and cardamom, mixing with formaldehyde, rouline, acetone, pine saw, and bleach. A place where folklore, rumors, tall tales, and jokes from the old country are told expanded, laughter erupting in back rooms the size of rich people's closets, into an eerie, untouched quiet. It's a makeshift classroom where we arrive fresh off the boat, the plane, the depths, hoping the salon would be a temporary stop until we get on our feet, or rather, until our jaws soften around English syllables, bend over workbooks at manicure desks, finishing homework for nighttime ESL classes that cost a quarter of our wages. I won't stay here long, we might say. I'll get a real job soon. But more often than not, sometimes within months, even weeks, we will walk back into the shop, heads lowered, our manicure drills inside paper bags tucked under our arms, and ask for our jobs back. And often the owner, out of pity or understanding or both, will simply nod at an empty desk, for there is always an empty desk, because no one stays long enough and someone is always just gone. Because there are no salaries, healthcare, or contracts, the body being the only material to work with and work from, having nothing, it becomes its own contract, a testimony of presence. We will do this for decades until our lungs can no longer breathe without swelling, our livers hardening with chemicals, our joints brittle and inflamed from arthritis, stringing together a kind of life. A new immigrant, within 2 years, will come to know that the salon is, in the end, a place where dreams become the calcified knowledge of what it means to be awake in American bones, with or without citizenship, aching, toxic, and underpaid. I hate and love your battered hands, Ma, for what they can never be.
From the book, On Earth, We're Briefly Gorgeous, which was won the T.S. Eliot Prize, the Whiting Award, the Tom Gunn Award, the Forward Prize for Best First Collection, a Ruth Lilly Fellow from the Poetry Foundation. He's received so many fellowships. As I say, we would be in our pajamas if I tried to read them all. But now you know what this book is about. The Size of Rich People's Closets, Ocean. Oh, man, the specificity in this, the listing, the motion, the way you move like liquid silver down that page. Really, you must have written this in a trance. Honestly, my heart was beating so fast.
That's so kind of you. That's so kind of you, Grace. I wish it was a trance. But it's more like a clockmaker putting little tiny pieces into it and hope it doesn't fall apart.
No, I think that page that you read was motion lotion. I don't think that thing was put together like a puzzle. That is all of one piece. And the interesting thing is that, you know, there is autobiography in our novels, but don't you think that everything is fiction but the feelings in this world?
Absolutely.
Everything is fiction but the feelings.
I actually think, I agree with you. I think actually poetry taught me how to be a fiction writer. Because as we spoke so far so richly in my first collection, you know, at the seat of Dante and Homer at Gilgamesh, it's about moving from truth into the imaginary, moving from truth into the myth. And so poetry taught me that our sense of historical truth or journalistic truth is only the beginning. It is the foundation of the work in which the imagination must finish the architecture. The entire architecture that we see is the work of the imagination. And I took that into the novel. And it was so liberating. I tried to write a memoir and I failed because I was so nervous about getting it right. And I realized I'm no journalist. I can't do this. And also when I started to research for a memoir, I started to ask folks questions. I started to ask my family questions. And within 30 minutes, I would be in tears. I couldn't do it. That's what I meant when I said I don't have the courage to be a memoirist. And I thought, well, what would happen instead if I posed the same questions to characters? Mm-hmm. If I created an alternative universe, a parallel universe, a simulation, if you will. To me, the novel is a simulation of the questions that I think are too difficult to ask people. And I told myself as an artist when I first started that whatever I make, it cannot hurt real people.
Oh, I am with you. I say to my students, what is your spiritual intention? If we look at our spiritual intentions, then we can never really go wrong. So I am very moved by the way you live your life. And I'd like to go back to your poems because mm-hmm. they swim on the page. And there is not a, we don't see the lumps under the mattress. We don't see the nuts and bolts. We just see this aesthetic on the page, which seems to love space a lot. So do you want to remark a moment about how you make it pretty?
Yeah, I think my first, I try to get the words right. And so I write by hand in a notebook. Mm-hmm. So at times it looks almost nothing like a poem. It looks like a, you know, a journal entry of someone perhaps on the verge of losing their mind. but then after a while, you know, I shape it. And so I think sculpting is so important. And when that happens, space and emptiness, and I think any architecture will tell you this, is also matter. Space is also a decision. Mm-hmm. Of course, Keats, you know, calls this negative capability. And I think that's very right. And so I asked the poem, how do you want to stand? You have what you want to say, but how do you want to stand in a way that would amplify your words? And I almost ask it. I said, well, we have many options. And so as a writer in form, and when considering form and space, I almost am not so much an architect, but I kind of just make room. I make sure there's enough capacious options for the poem. And so throughout my education as a poet, I adapted and learned as many forms as possible, because every poem has their own terms, their own physics. And the more capacious we are to them, the more possibilities there are.
Yes, and form is really only the way we hold the work. So, and it takes its own, it has its own mind. You're right about that. But imagination is this house we go into, and it is the legend that you make. It's the mythology that you make, but it is our imagined house. And so how we want to decorate that house and how we want to make space is really about us. It's about our aesthetics and our taste and how we want to present ourselves. Mm-hmm. And finally, I'm dying to know how you teach poetry. Somebody asked me about my methodology of teaching. I've been teaching for 50 years. Yeah. And I said, I teach just like Miss O'Malley taught me in the third grade. Mm. And it doesn't get any better than that. She knew, she saw us and she heard us. And by God, you can't get enough degrees to do that. Yes. So how do you approach poetry? I know you're teaching C.D. Wright right now, right?
Yes. Yes, I love C.D. Wright.
Why did you choose her? And what do you make your own choices? I'm sure you do.
Yeah, I teach graduate students, and the great pleasure of that is, you know, we get to make our own syllabus. And
we should say the University of Massachusetts Amherst.
Yes, yes. It's a pleasure. I mean, you know, I don't take any of it for granted. Mm-hmm. To show up to your job and not have it feel like a job is a miracle to me. You know, no one in my family has ever gotten to do that. So I relish it. And I do. I teach a hybrid course. So I teach, you know, Ann Carson, C.D. Wright, Banu Kapil, Marguerite Duras, The Lover. And so I'm interested in blending the line between where poetry decides to leave its more conventional forms behind and to move towards prose-like intergenre innovations. And C.D. Wright has always been an incredible innovative writer, both in how she uses idioms, vernaculars, local speech with sort of more academic speech. And that sort of democratic gaze on language is very important. But yes, my method, I don't know. I had good teachers. I was very lucky to have good teachers, you know.
Can I audit your course?
More, it will be a pleasure. We can teach it together, I'm sure.
Oh, it sounds like heaven, love supreme, love supreme.
Oh, but my teacher, I was very lucky to be taught by Sharon Olds at NYU.
I understand that.
And Sharon's approach to the workshop was to not critique until the fourth or fifth week. And it took everyone by surprise, because we students see the workshop at times as a sort of factory. Put the poem on the conveyor belt, fix it up, and it comes out the other end better and ready for publication. And so they were kind of very almost agitated that Sharon kind of refused to have the workshop become this repair line, right? And so she said, we're not going to repair. We're going to recognize. We're going to see how the poems are standing on their own terms, so that we get to know the poet, so that no rule could be forced on any poem. And it was so eye-opening.
Wow.
Because we saw how defunct universal literary laws were by the fourth and fifth week, because we realized that every poet has their own goals and ambitions. And we now have to cater. After the fourth week, we knew what everybody was about. We knew what their style was, what their obsessions were. And when our critiques finally came, they came already personalized for that person and their aesthetic, because we've been learning. It wasn't that we were just wasting time. We were learning a muscle that is often atrophied in our literary considerations, and that muscle is recognition, to recognize what is happening as it is without thinking of repair.
I am blown away. I wouldn't allow anyone that I know to fix anybody else's work, but I never thought of spending the whole time just getting people to form themselves. But then when you say critique it, do you mean by Sharon or by the other participants?
Everyone. We would do it together by the fourth and fifth week. And before that, from the beginning till then, it was all about, what do we see?
Mm.
What do you see here?
Mm-hmm.
What's happening here? Why do we think this color is chosen over another?
Wow.
So it's almost a hermeneutic approach without any suggestion, until that hermeneutic approach lends to a clearer and personalized understanding of the poet's objectives.
I love you with all my heart. Can we have a final poem?
Yes. I wanted to end with this poem because I write about violence a lot, and I wanted in this book to have a moment of ceasefire, a real decisive moment of choosing nonviolence between father and son. And, you know, our country, as you know, particularly, in and around D.C., has been in turmoil. And so I want to end our beautiful conversation, Grace, with a moment of a ceasefire here. It's called The Smallest Measure. Behind the fallen oak, the Winchester rattles in a boy's early hands. A copper beard grazes his ear. Go ahead. She's all yours. Heavy with summer. I am the doe whose one hoof cocks like a question ready to open roots. And like any God-forsaken thing, I want nothing more than my breaths. To lift the snout, carved from centuries of hunger, toward the next low peach bruising in the season's clutch. Go ahead, the voice thicker now. Drive her home. But the boy is crying into the carcass of a tree, cheeks smeared with snot and chipped bark. Once I came near enough to a man to smell a woman's scent in his quiet praying, as some will do before raising their weapons closer to the sky. But through the grained mist that makes this morning's minutes, the smallest measure of distance, I see two arms unhinging the rifle from the boy's grip, its metallic shine sharpened through wet leaves. I see the rifle coming down, then gone. I see an orange cap touching an orange cap. No, a man bending over his son, the way the hunted for centuries must bend over its own reflection to drink.
The voice of Ocean Vuong. Think about the word ocean, what that means. Think about the color of the ocean, the movement, the depth, the motion, what's underneath. This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. It is produced by Forest Woods Media Productions. Our post-production is by Mike Turpin, MET Studios. We wish to thank the Library of Congress for making this program possible. Funding is provided by the Rivada Foundation of the Logan family and additional support by the Sinipid Fund and Diane Wilbon Parks. I'm Grace Cavalieri. Our engineer is Mike Turpin.